Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the aftermath of the devastating earthquake and tsunami in Japan. We speak to the regional coordinator for Caritas Asia to find out just how the church is responding to the emergency. And the International Year for Forests, as the UN focuses on crucial conservation and sustainable management questions, we delve deeper into the religious and spiritual dimensions of this environmental issue. In Japan, a major international rescue effort continues to help locate survivors of the devastating earthquake and tsunami that hit the northeast coast of the country on Friday, March the 11th. The death toll is expected to rise to at least 10,000 victims of what was the strongest earthquake since records began in Japan. As well as searching for bodies in the area hit by the tsunami, the country has been in the grip of mounting fears of a nuclear disaster resulting from a damaged nuclear power station in the area. As the country continues to grapple with the fast-evolving rescue and humanitarian situation, my colleague Lydia O'Kane spoke to Father Bonnie Mendes. He's regional coordinator for Caritas Asia to find out how the church in Japan is responding to this disaster.
Yes, I think we have to look at it in the context of Japan, that despite the fact that it's been hit by such a disaster, it has not panicked. And the government has responded very quickly and as efficiently as possible. And Caritas Japan you have to locate it in that particular context. It is not a helpless Caritas. Instead, it believes in helping the government itself to really help people. And therefore, it is not like the normal disaster that we have in other countries. At this particular phase, I'm talking about relief and also what is happening in the context of the nuclear power station. I mean, they are looking at it as they're going to help the government as much as possible. The different dioceses that have been affected in the prefectures, they are very active there. And at the same time, church itself has lost one of its MEP missionaries from Canada. Therefore, is itself very sorry for the victims. And there have been Christians among the Japanese who have died. But it's really at this stage not acting directly. It is indirectly through the dioceses and helping the government as much as possible. But there's been such a big sort of response internationally of sympathy, and looking at the disaster, people want to contribute. And therefore, Caritas Japan is now given for the first time, its account number, so that money can be sent, and that money will be used for the rehabilitation phase. That will take some time because it will require very thorough planning, but the Japanese will do it in their own style, and they're going to do it well, I'm sure.
This earthquake, following then on with a tsunami, happened last Friday. Are we still in a rescue phase? Is there still hope of finding a lot of people alive?
Now, once again, this has become a really technical sort of job. Searching for victims is not, you know, just looking at the debris. And therefore, very specialized teams have gone in with sniffer dogs and so on. And they're searching for victims. And that is still continuing because the area affected is big. And even, you know, the first phase, the dogs have gone there and the people have looked at with different kinds of equipment, searching for people who might be alive under the debris. But there have been only a few cases where they have been detected, according to the reports being given to us by Caritas Japan. In normal circumstances, Caritas Japan, we would phone But in this particular case, we are depending on emails because the phone lines also have been affected. And at the same time, we do not want to burden them with too many emails. So we are allowing them to, you know, at their leisure, to give us as much information, and we are sharing that information with others.
You were talking earlier about the church's response, the different dioceses. Looking at what people need right now, what is it that people need most?
Japanese society, once again, is reacting very reasonably. They are rationing things like petrol and diesel. They are supplying water as required. And therefore, they are doing it with great discipline. There's no wastage of any kind of electricity, water, food stocks. I mean, they're doing it with great discipline. And therefore, they're not asking for international aid of that kind as yet. But if needed, everybody is prepared to rush it with that kind of aid, especially Korea. Korea has just sent in $100,000 to Caritas Japan in case they need it. But they're trying to use funds more for rehabilitation than the emergency phase.
How many lessons have been learned? Many people will remember the terrible tsunami of 2004. A lot of measures were put in place then. How much has that helped now for disasters such as this?
Caritas Asia made use of the knowledge we had of, or the experience we had of the tsunami. So we got people from India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, Australia, and we put together their experiences from different points of view, the social activists, the designers, the engineers, the architects, and their experiences have been documented in a shelter working group document. So we have those experiences documented. We did not want to reinvent the wheel each time a disaster takes place. So all that we've learned, we've put together in a document. And we've also had training done on disasters in Asia. But East Asia, because its government responds to these kinds of things, they did not participate. But definitely they're going to look at these experiences of building and what type of houses need to be built and how far from the sea and other things like that. They're going to look at it very seriously. And we will send them this manual as quickly as possible. It's being printed in India now as I'm talking. Different experts coming together, with a lot of people giving their feedback. It's been documented, and we've learned a lot from the tsunami of 2004. We were totally unprepared for that. But even though we are prepared for such a disaster, the magnitude of this disaster and the magnitude of the earthquake, both hitting an advanced country, is really very significant. And now with the nuclear disaster also, that's another phase that we really don't know what to do and, you know, how it's going to affect people in the long run.
That's something I was just going to come to, the nuclear situation. Obviously, for many people, again, they're being asked to stay in their homes. A lot of people have been evacuated from that affected area. Again, it's another complication.
It is certainly another complication, and people who are affected are being moved out, and people on their own also are moving out, but again with great discipline. Whatever feedback we are getting, it's done with discipline, it's done rigorously, and this is very different from other societies, each one helping the other as required, but in a very Japanese style of doing it. What other consequences there will be from this nuclear, we do not know. And definitely countries that have nuclear power now will have to look very closely at damages that can happen anyway. I don't think Italy has, but Germany has really already reviewing their own nuclear sites and so on. It's a new ball game, completely different from the past.
We look back at the tsunami again of 2004, and we see from there was a huge loss of life. Is it of similar proportions, this situation in Japan?
I don't think it's similar proportions. Because that hit different countries, the disaster was bigger. People died in Thailand, people died in India, people died in Sri Lanka, in Indonesia. That was very different. Here it's only Japan, but even then, we really don't know how many died. And the warning was given immediately after the earthquake. So people did rush out, but the water also came so fast that it was difficult to escape. Not everybody could escape. The warnings were given very, very quickly in Japan. So now the warning has been lifted, but, you know, people are still afraid.
You talked about Japan being a very structured country. They have got things in place to deal with situations. It's also economically sound country with regards to other nations. But still, despite all that, again, looking back to the tsunami of 2004, the reconstruction, there's going to be so much needed to get Japan back on its feet.
Yes, but again, you know, if they really divert their attention to reconstruction, they're going to do it in a gigantic way, and they'll do it their own style. It's not like other countries that will, you know, do it haphazard way. So I'm sure already people are at the drawing board, sitting and drawing and making, you know, all kinds of adjustments and making it a very earthquake-proof structure and so on. But with all that, when anything that hits that of this magnitude, I don't know what you can do.
My thanks there to Father Bonnie Mendes, Regional Coordinator for Caritas Asia, talking to my colleague Lydia O'Kane. Throughout the year 2011, the United Nations is marking an International Year for Forests, celebrating especially the essential role of forests for our human existence. Over two-thirds of all biodiversity on land is found in the forests, but over 1.5 billion people also depend directly on the forest for their livelihood. That's why the logo for this UN year features the central role of us human beings in the sustainable management and conservation of our world's forests. But there's another deeper dimension for Christians to consider, a dimension that goes right to the heart of our faith.
Nature, the natural world, it is not simply God telling us something, but it is God revealing himself. And even in Thomas Aquinas, we find the first glimmerings of this.
Dr. John Feehan is a well-known author and professor at University College Dublin's School of Biology and Environmental Science. He's particularly concerned that churches around the world this year should get involved with what is potentially the greatest emergency facing our planet today.
Deforestation has really become such a fundamental problem because of population growth. It is essentially the burgeoning growth of the human population that has led to this vast increase in deforestation over the last 40, 50 years particularly. And much of the concern, especially since the conference in Rio de Janeiro, 12, 13 years ago now, concerned about the practical implications of the loss of function, forest function, the loss of resources, etc., has become increasingly to the forefront. But one of the things that I have noticed myself over the last number of years is that other values in forest and in forest biodiversity have tended to kind of slip between the cracks, so to speak. We're so concerned now with what the practical implications of the loss of forest would be for climate, for resources, for populations, etc., etc., that we've tended to lose sight of the fact that the forest is the great reservoir of biodiversity on Earth. And all of God's revelation in nature, if you like, is dimming like a rainbow dimming before the sun, so to speak. So I've been trying to readdress the concern, not ignoring, of course, all the practical side of things, but to look more, again, at the spiritual dimension of the loss of forest and the biodiversity resources that it harbours.
On the practical side, you have some very alarming figures about the complete loss of all forests in just over 100 years
or so. It is stunning, and in not just 100 years, I mean, in decades. we have lost. For example, Madagascar. The loss in Madagascar has been over decades rather than over a century. The figures are absolutely astounding. But we seem to be able to kind of skate along and not take the seriousness or the implications of this loss on board, certainly not in any practical sense. Because in spite of all the resolutions we have taken, the declarations that we've passed, we still see this steady trickle away of biodiversity between our fingers. I mean, for example, if one looks at the glossy national biodiversity action plans of all the nations of the earth, I mean, they're very, very impressive on paper. Some of them running to hundreds of pages, and what we have and what we're going to do. But if you actually look at ground level, at community level, on the ground, and see what is actually happening, we find that still the trickle is continuing, in spite of success stories here and there. But the overall,
for example,
trend, some of the work of the International Union for Conservation of Nature, for example, the establishment of parks, the focus on charismatic species and bringing them back from the brink, etc. Those are small success stories, and they tend to get headlines. But the steady trickle, the steady loss, especially in terms of area, of land lost to natural forest, still continues.
You talk about this spiritual dimension or the moral dimension of this loss of biodiversity. Tell us a little bit more about what you understand by that.
Well, taking a few steps backward, I suppose, if we look back at the perception that began to develop, particularly, we say, in the 16th century, that the natural world, nature, the universe that we confront, that confronts us or that is before us, it is not simply the stage, the furniture on which the human drama is enacted, but is, in fact, it is the first revelation, so to speak. I mean, that is all there is in terms of revelation in a literal sense, if you think of the human in the world looking out. What nature is, it is everything. And anything spiritual that we have ever moved into the second revelation, so to speak, is distilled ultimately from that. And many theologians would take it much further to the extent of saying that nature, the natural world, it is not simply God telling us something, but it is God revealing himself. And even in Thomas Aquinas, we find the first glimmerings of this, to quote loosely, God cannot express himself in any one creature, and so he has created this multitude of different species so that what one lacks as an expression of divine goodness, the others can make up. I mean, what that is saying, that this is the self-revelation of God. And that's in Thomas Aquinas' day, before we really had any real sense of just how mesmerizingly complex and impressive biological diversity is. I mean, we knew nothing about invertebrate life, which is that is biodiversity, or about lesser plants, so to speak. We knew nothing about the biodiversity of the tropics. We knew absolutely nothing about the biodiversity of the oceans, for example. So if Thomas were alive today and confronting the same question, what is God about, in both senses of the word, with the natural world, I mean, he would be stuck for words. You know, how to express it now? The other side of it is, and this is where science comes in, what science being the human ability to read what is being said to us in nature. And what science has shown us over the last, again, within the last century, is that these other species are not just wooden figures, not just static furniture on the stage. They are all as complex as we are in terms of their biochemistry, their genetics, their physiology. And what has dawned on us over the 120 years since Darwin, of course, is that they're not just furniture on the human stage, but they are our brothers and sisters. We are related. And this utterly changes the question that confronts us about how do we respond to a creation which is all of this. It's not what we used to think 50 or 100 years ago, but God is about so much more here that it puts an absolutely moral responsibility on us to take all of that seriously in how we respond to deforestation, which brings us back to the forest. Yeah? The forest is where it all, in a sense, kind of focuses on.
You talk about trees as a way of life, don't you, and the forest in our genes.
Yes.
Tell us, what do you understand by this?
Trees as a way of life, I mean, it sounds a simplistic question to ask. You know, what is a tree? Because we all know what is a tree. But there's much more to it, because trees are the dominant long-lived life forms on Earth that gather around all the rest of biodiversity to themselves. So they are the permanent architecture of the natural world, so to speak. Everything else comes and goes, you know, over months away. They are there for hundreds, for thousands of years. So, I mean, they are really the pillars of biological diversity on Earth. That's what I mean by it's a way of life in an ecological sense. And the psychological end of it, again, if we look at human evolution, we were born in trees, in a sense. Put it this way, physically we are made for an atmosphere with 20% oxygen. I mean, physically, everything about it. If that is gradually reduced, say to 15%, we're not made for that, physically. But it's the same psychologically. Psychologically, we are made for a landscape which is dominated by nature, of which trees are the long-lived permanent residents and everything that goes with them. And our biological nature has, in fact, evolved to be comfortable in that kind of situation. If you take us away from it, we're no longer, almost literally, we are no longer at home. We don't feel at home, we feel less comfortable. Something is missing from our experience. So in that sense, we are almost genetically programmed to have trees around us. Forget about the spiritual side of it for the moment, but in purely psychological terms. And I mean, it's no accident, therefore, that if you walk through a park in the middle of a city, for instance, you respond to this sense of greater ease or being more at home in the natural world, etc. So we suffer if it's taken away, basically, psychologically and spiritually, because of these deeper revelation of God dimensions that we've been talking about.
You talked about the church's response to this. Over the centuries, the church has had great difficulty, despite, as you say, right back to the earliest centuries, having some glimmer of understanding of the profound effect that this would have on our theology, on our thinking.
Yeah. Well, we're still only at the beginning of it, I think. I mean, there's always the danger of thinking that at long last, after 2,000 years, we finally got the final theology. But put it this way, the Scottish historian Dermot McCulloch published a huge, thick, big book 2 years ago on the history of Christianity. Wonderful for putting everything in perspective, but the subtitle of it was Christianity, the first 3,000 years. The first 3,000 years. What he's saying there really is, not only is Christianity not confined to 2,000 years, but it took 1,000 years to prepare for it, so to speak, and there is another 2,000 years ahead, if we can use our reason and get things right. But one of the points he's making is, and this is very hard for maybe a lot of theologians to accept, is that in the theology of 1,000 years hence, if we can manage to get there, will be as different from the theology of today as ours is from Nicaea. You know, in other words, it is not set. One of the dangers with the councils is that they set thinking in concrete, and it prevents it from maturing in response to a better understanding of creation. And this is what this is about. Our understanding of creation has been simply revolutionised in the last 100 years. But theology is very slow to catch up with it.
Why do you think this is?
Well, change demands, it's challenging. It demands courage, etc. It's more comfortable to say, well, look, we've got this far and this is better than it was before. As Bernard Lonergan once put it, the church always arrives on the scene a little late and a little breathless. Very much the case here.
There's very much a fear, isn't there, of moving away from the human-centric into the world of creation as such.
And also into the much more demanding openness to divinity that this requires. The understanding that science has confronted it with requires a more mature understanding, insofar as the human can ever understand what is behind it all, of God is. And that can be frightening. But I mean, go back, St. Paul has it there in a nutshell. When you were a child, you thought as a child and did all the things of a child, and you played like a child. But now you've grown up. You can't turn your back on what science tells us about. I mean, for instance, if you're talking to a group of grown-up adults, all of whom are well-educated, etc., and you try to confront them with the reality that you and a spider, you are sisters, it always brings a very uncomfortable snigger.
It's seen as a bit New Agey, isn't it? A little bit.
Yeah, and the bombshell hasn't sunk home. The reality of it, that this is not just an uncomfortable. It's true, and it bounces back to us the question. Well, who did we think we were in the first place? And the Book of Job has an awful lot to say that's very illuminating on that. Who do we think we are? But finally, we're confronted with this realization that our understandings of God up to now have been those of a child, really.
What would you like to see the church perhaps offering in terms of this greater understanding, this ability to add an extra dimension, if you like, to what is undoubtedly a great concern about the future of our planet?
Well, taking it on board in theology in the first instance, which we've been very slow to do. I mean, theology really hasn't opened itself up to only a fraction of the extent it needs to what the advances of science in the last several, well, one, the last century has been. But in addition to that, the need to take much seriously action at ground level, fundamentally at community stroke parish level, because that's where this sort of thing translates into success. If you, having taken some of these insights on board, you then look back to where I live and where I'm grounded, the parish I live in, the community I live in, and ask, what do I need to do now to show that I take this seriously in my own life and in the lives of those close to me? Which is why I tend to focus a lot on getting the parish level involved. For instance, every country has its national biodiversity action plan, and that's devolved down to local authorities. The local authorities are supposed to have the local area biodiversity action plan. I don't know, well, I know of very few instances where the church at local level has said to itself, okay, here is the biodiversity action plan. We have a moral, religious dimension to bring to this. How are we going to get involved with it? How are we going to translate it into, how are we going to talk about it in our communities? How are we going to talk about it in our churches? It's not happening at all.
And yet it would be a way of perhaps bringing people back into the church, would it, through this connection to the natural world?
Well, absolutely. And also, it would be a way of showing that the church takes the advance of science more seriously, takes the implications for knowledge or understanding of the advance of science more seriously. Because one of the things that young people find, especially educated young people, find difficult is that the church doesn't seem to take some of the findings of science seriously. It takes the technology seriously because it's useful and can use it, but not some of the implications for how we understand ourselves in relation to God, in relation to others, in relation to the natural world, etc., etc. This would show that that is being taken much more seriously, and that would bring an awful lot of young people back into, well, I won't say back into the church, because it would be a changing church, if you like, a different fold.
But to connect up the theological issues with these very practical concerns.
Yeah, because, I mean, it is all of a piece. The perception that theology and church has had nothing got to do with what the world is really all about and what matters in the world, that's the big gap in the understanding of a lot of young people.
Going back to the Year of the Forest and our hopes, our perspectives for this year, perhaps what other practical efforts, can you give us any examples of things that are being done, positive examples of where this kind of church involvement has actually made a difference?
Well, again, you can be a member of all sorts of organisations. You can give your money to Save the Whales and, you know, that. But that action at a distance isn't the real demand. The real demand is closer to home, as I was saying. Focusing on what can I do that hurts almost, that I have to give time to, that I have to give attention to, that I have to relate to other people in the context of. In Ireland, in my own, where I'm more closely involved with this, there are one or two local communities which have taken their county development plan on board and said, what are the ethical implications for Christians in becoming involved with that? And that is a kind of a model that I think needs to be taken much more widely. I mean, communities throughout the world need to be saying, what can we do as a community to show that we're taking this biodiversity conservation action seriously?
My thanks there to Dr. John Feehan, author and professor at University College Dublin School of Biology and Environmental Science. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can. And don't forget, our news and feature programmes can all be found on our website, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.